Welcome to the CCM Deep Dive Podcast as we go song by song and story by story through some of Christian music's most influential albums with the artists who created them. It's time to grab your coffee and settle in. Let's go.
I keep saying yes because people keep asking me to play. And that's kind of all you ever get to do. Like, don't stop writing and doing what you're doing. And if people say yes, then go play. It's that simple.
Welcome to Loose Ends, the 10th and final episode with Jennifer Knapp, as we wrap up our journey through her 1998 major label debut album, Kansas, with Goatee Records. Before the Faithful to Me reprise that closes out the album, there's a song that you just heard in the opening, Visions, a bright little up-tempo song with mandolin fills.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is in the cadre of like Romans and Undo Me. It was another upbeat song I think I was trying to write for, you know, my Christian rock band that I was a part of.
That Christian rock band was Captured. Jennifer talked about her time with them back in episode 5.
The challenging thing about this song for anyone who's ever tried to play it, and to this date, I've never seen anyone do like a YouTube cover of it. So knock yourselves out if you can do it. But basically, the problem with it is not a standard beat. So it's actually the tempo. There's a tempo change in the song, but also the verses are in what is essentially 8-8. So it's a 1-2-3-1-2-3-1-2 feel. So it looks kind of like a 4-4, but it's actually an 8-8 that has a, you know, a 3-bar. Either a 6-8 and what would be a 3-8 bar, or you could just call it an 8-8. But that's all, that's musical nerd talk for saying it goes from that feel to then a 6-8 feel. So then it drops essentially, what's like 5 beats to where the bar patterns are at.
If that all sounds confusing, don't worry. Here's the gist.
This gives rock people nightmares to try and play live. And when, so even though I wrote it for my band back in the day, I mean, we were amateur enough that like kind of living in the feel of what it takes to kind of play the song, it was really vexing because you can't count it 1 and 2 and 3, and it's 1-2-3-1-2-3-1-2. It's a totally different way of counting. So my musical background in classical music, that didn't really bother me too much. But yeah, it made it problematic for making a case to have this be on a record. And as a result, didn't get a lot of performances live because I think I tried to add it even with my own bands from time and again, but it can be problematic. I mean, even when we did nail, there were a couple of years, I think we brought it out on tour. And even when we could kind of get the transitions okay, it had a tendency to rush and be kind of nutty. So the wheels would kind of always fall off of it at the end.
So while there are a few songs on this album that Jennifer does not like to play anymore because of her personal beliefs, this isn't one of them. It's just a bit too much to pull off musically. After Visions, the album comes full circle with a reprise of Faithful to Me, the opening song. So it's only fitting that the story of Jennifer Knapp also goes back to the beginning, back to Pittsburgh, Kansas.
I really like what I call them, guitar-slinging chick singers.
That's Byron Funk. Jennifer's story and the story of Kansas can't be told properly without his story being told. At the beginning of every artist's career is a manager, encourager, guide, and mentor. No one gets to the top by themselves. So just like the movie The Lion King 1.5, this is the same story, Jennifer's story, from a different perspective.
I generally prefer female singers to male. And so I was always looking for some girl to work with. I had done a little bit of producing of my own music. I was not really much of a writer musically or lyrically. I maybe thought that at one point, but then as I looked back at my lyrics, I realized I wasn't. Well, really, it was more of when you're around a Jennifer Knapp or other people who really write well, you go, okay, I am not a writer. I cannot write something like From Glass Alabaster, She Poured Out the Depths of Her Soul. I mean, that lyric is phenomenal. You know, I would just say the lady poured out the perfume on his feet, you know, and just that's what I would say. So when you're around a fantastic songwriter like Jen, there's just, you just realize there's a gift there that I don't possess. Now, what can I do to help develop that gift?
But let's start at the beginning. Jennifer graduated high school in 1991 before enrolling at Pittsburgh State University on a music scholarship. And just a few years later,
the story goes that we moved back to Pittsburgh in 1994 for my wife to take this job. And one of the first Sundays that we went to back to a church that we had attended previously, this young gal got up on stage. She sang this song and forgot the lyrics to her own song. So she looked around and some of her friends helped her remember the words to the song that she had written. And so she finished out the song. And as we left that evening from that church, I looked at my wife and said, I think I found my gal. There's something special here. My wife thought I was pretty crazy because, you know, but there was, from the moment I heard her sing, there was something special about her voice, her playing, just her presence that she has what they call the it factor. And it's hard to, you know, you hear that all the time, but it's hard to really see that until you really see it. And she definitely had it.
If you recall, it was around this time that Jennifer was both taking her first steps as an independent artist and navigating questions within her newfound Christian faith, which historically has always allowed for some latitude of discourse before it starts to move into the arena of heresy. In Jennifer's words,
I'm not an evangelical theologically. I don't adopt that. And I didn't know that at the time.
Evangelical Christianity, or sometimes called evangelical Protestantism, is a subgroup within the interdenominational Protestant Christian faith worldwide that emphasizes the authority of the Bible and the importance of personal conversion. They also, as a general rule, tend to be more conservative both in their theology and on social issues. So while Jennifer has since moved away from what is considered mainstream Christianity, that was her entry point into the faith 30 years ago.
She was. When I'd met her, she was very new in her Christian faith, very new.
Again, Jennifer's first manager and bandmate, Byron Funk.
And she was expressing that faith, that newfound faith, through singing and song. I don't know. I knew she was a trumpet player, that she was, you know, in the trumpet and music department at Pitt State, and that she was not a well-developed guitar player at the time. And for whatever reason, she started, she wrote this one song, probably because she picked up the guitar. And, you know, she talks about that in, you know, on her own terms, in your podcast. And she decided to start expressing her newfound faith through this thing called guitar singing. And so she was a Christian when I met her and started working with her. She was already in this band that she had mentioned called Captured. I've heard her in her book and when she talks about it, it's intriguing to me because she mentions that band as kind of a pivotal moment in her life. I see that band as not as pivotal in. I don't see it as pivotal because the band wasn't really that good. So it's like, but when I saw the band perform, because I'd seen them perform, I knew she was in this band. And so I'd seen them perform. I was like, okay, this band has not much special, but she has something special. So the story goes is the band leader, they needed some PA equipment to do a gig. They knew I had some PA equipment. So they asked me to join the band because they needed a bass player too. So I joined the band. The only reason I said yes was because she was in the band, because I knew that she was special and I wanted a way to get closer to her without sounding like a creeper. So I joined the band kind of knowing on the outset that the band really wasn't going anywhere. Now that said, to be fair to the band, I still put a lot of effort into the band. I did my part. It's not like I was trying to sabotage the band, but I knew that she was something special and that I wanted to be a part of that. But bands are notoriously fragile, and it's complicated. You can't just take the band and go do three songs at a youth group on a Wednesday night. She could. And so she was able to, we were able to get tons and tons of gigs for her. I don't have it in front of me, but in 95, because her career, her independent career pretty well started early 95, 95, 96, and 97, she was doing 80 to 90 appearances, gigs, whatever you want to call them, a year while still being a full-time college student. So, you know, she was working pretty hard.
As it often goes, hard work creates opportunities. And for Jennifer, the opportunity presented itself one evening in Kansas City.
One of her favorite artists at the time, and I think she mentioned it, was Sixpence None the Richer. And there was a coffee house, a venue called New Earth Coffee House in Kansas City that brought in Christian talent that was just basically rolling through town every weekend. So Friday, Saturday nights, they'd have all the underground bands, the signed bands, but really not the, I mean, they didn't have Michael Bobby Smith or Amy Grant. They had Sixpence None the Richer. And that was kind of a big gig for them. And they had all the Tooth and Nail bands and all of that kind of stuff that was going on at the time. So again, this is mid 90s. She loved Sixpence None the Richer. And I knew that Sixpence was doing this gig in October of what year was that? 95. No, 94. This is before we'd even recorded anything yet. So I picked up the phone, called Sheldon Kalavig, who ran New Earth Coffee House. And I said, hey, I know you don't know me and you don't know this girl, but she loves Sixpence. Could you put her on the bill? And he said, well, we usually like to listen to them before we do anything, but she can have two songs at the front of the show. And there was another artist opening for Sixpence, and I don't remember who that was, but there was Jen and then another artist and then Sixpence. So it was a Friday or Saturday night in October of 94. We drove up there. She did her two songs, was a smashing hit. And so after the Sixpence had played, I think she stayed around and hung out and played another song or two. That was really a launching point where then they asked her back in November and December of the same year. And that was really the catalyst. New Earth was really the spot where she found her wings. It was a great place. They were really welcoming. Normally, you know, they had a lot of hard rock, a lot of that kind of a thing. And Jen wasn't that, but a lot of the audience people would talk to her and to me and say, you know, it's really refreshing because our ears are getting pounded all night by all this music. And then Jen brings this breath of fresh air from a different perspective, and it's not cheesy and it's really good. New Earth was really pivotal to her career. That was really, that played a huge role in her getting started, was at New Earth. And then from there, I told her best advertising was her. She would do a gig, she would give out my number, and from that one gig, two people would call me. And so it was always that way. She'd do a gig, two people would call me. And so from that point on, my phone just rang off the hook. It was the greatest thing ever as a manager, booking agent, whatever. Brand new artist, didn't have a recording yet. And my phone was starting to ring saying, hey, can Jen come out here and do something? A lot of it was youth group gigs. But even, you know, she did a pretty good sized gig at the end of 94, which was just, you know, two or three months into her career for a Southern Baptist event. You know, she played in front of like 1,000 kids, you know, two or three months into her career, which was fantastic.
So what Jennifer may have lacked in experience initially, she more than made up for in charisma and stage presence.
She's always been super expressive and super friendly and super engaging is probably the best word. It was amazing to watch her in front of an audience. She'd go to these youth group gigs where there was 50 kids in the audience. And as part of her shtick, maybe it's a carnival act, but it was really impactful for the kids. She would learn all the kids' names and then recite them from the stage. you know, probably 50 was about the max, but it was impressive. And that really, obviously, if you're a kid and this girl is up on stage and she's singing her own songs and it's cool. And then she said my name, and then she said my name again. You know, it was massively impactful.
One of the challenges in navigating Jennifer's career at the time, aside from her lack of playing experience, is the fact that she was just learning about what it means to be a follower of Jesus while learning what it means to be an artist on the road. Fair or not, Jennifer had to grow up quickly in both areas, and Byron had a front seat.
Her faith was, to me, was massively authentic and impactful to lots and lots and lots of people. You know, anybody that she was in front of. Now, that said, you know, I've thought about this a little bit since then, that some churches or some organizations, they don't allow new Christians to go and be evangelists for the first year. We want to get you discipled. I've read that a little bit in her book and pulled some of that out of there, where she was thrust into this spotlight where she had to be a mouthpiece for God, talking about her faith before she probably was ready to, or before that had really received a massive solid footing.
Part of Byron's job was to help Jen's spiritual walk, and he had a woman from that coffee house in Kansas City go with her on several trips to help provide some spiritual maturity and guidance. When Jen wasn't on the road, she was in Byron's studio recording songs for her first album. The release of that album, Wishing Well, contained several songs that would go on to be re-recorded for Kansas: the Kim Bontrager song, Refine Me, Trinity, Faithful to Me, and His Grace is Sufficient, along with a beautiful new version of Jesus Loves Me.
We got the shipment in. I took them over to Jen's house, you know, the excitement of opening up the box for the first time for your first record or whatever it was. And she was like, how in the world are we going to sell this many? And I was like, are you kidding me? So that first year that we recorded it late 95, it released technically late 95 or 94. So early 95, we had the cassette. We went through 2,200 cassettes in a year. So it was like, yeah, 200 are going to go fast and we're going to have to keep reordering, which we did. So it was late 95 where, you know, we knew we had to do a CD because everybody wanted a CD and they didn't want to have to dig up their Walkman or whatever to play the cassette. So we recorded 6 additional songs, put them all together, and then released the Wishing Well CD. I believe it was March of 96. We had a big CD release event in Pittsburgh, did a full band at a concert in a hall down in Pittsburgh, and had like 800 people show up. I don't know if we sold a lot of CDs that night. So then in the subsequent years after that was early 96, and she didn't sign with Goatee for another 18 months or so. We sold about 5,000 copies of Wishing Well.
This is where all of Byron's work started to pay off, because one of those copies landed in the home of a friend who produced some of the biggest youth music festivals at the time, like DCLA and Acquire the Fire.
And I've known this guy forever. And so I always said, you know, I'm not going to pester Raleigh. The guy's name was Raleigh Rickert, and I'm not going to pester him, but I'm just going to keep him involved with what I'm doing with Jen. So I'd send him a cassette, give him a little note. If he was in town, cause he'd come into town once in a while and then he'd like preach at our church, I'd make sure Jen was on the program that day. And so he knew who she was and he knew what I was doing. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I wasn't trying to hide the ball there. But he took the cassette home and his son found the cassette and his son really loved Jen. And so he was having a conversation at some point with Toby Mac, because he knew Toby Mac. He was helped DC Talk in the early years, etc. And Toby was kind of frustrated at the time because Toby's a child of the 80s like I am and likes the big production. I mean, you know, Toby has always liked the big production. And Toby was like, you know, I don't get it. All these kids today are they're like listening to these coffee house singers that just sing with a guitar. And, you know, it just makes no sense to me. And so Raleigh goes, I know what you're talking about. My son loves this girl named Jennifer Knapp. So Toby's like, oh, really? And so so Raleigh kind of was the go-between.
For the younger generation, this was all before music streaming. Back when you had to physically put music on cassettes and CDs, create the sleeves that contain the artwork, and package them all into the cases. Not super quick, easy, or cheap.
Back then, CD blanks were about $20 a piece, but you send them to Goatee if they ask for it, or to Toby Mac if he asked for it. So I sent it to them. They became really interested in signing Jen. I remember I was IT director at a school district at the time, and the phone rang, and I didn't have a phone at my desk. So the secretary paged me and said, hey, you got a phone call. So I took the phone call and said, hey, this is Toby Mac. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm at work right now at a school. And so, you know, that started a conversation. She got an offer from another record label as well. And she ended up signing with Goatee. And the rest of that is kind of history.
Unfortunately for Byron, that history didn't include him. Like Moses leading the Israelites in the wilderness, Byron took Jennifer just up to the promised land of being signed by a major record label, being led by arguably the biggest name in CCM at the time.
I liken it to a divorce because in some ways it was.
Each artist is ultimately responsible for their own career. And for Jennifer, she felt Byron had done all he could do for her and wanted a fresh start in Nashville.
That was a tough conversation.
For Byron, the divorce was bittersweet, for sure. He was Jennifer's manager, booking agent, mentor, and producer, while still holding down another full-time job.
I remember having a conversation with Toby. He had heard it. He'd listened to it. And people had been referring to Wishing Well as a demo. And so he took me. We were walking back from lunch or something, and it was just him and I. And I remember, I mean, something that, you know, will stay with me forever. He was like, I know we keep referring to it as a demo, and I know you put your heart and sweat, you know, you put your hard work into that, and I want to recognize you for that. And so it was, you know, it meant a lot to me because I had, you know, I'd put everything I could. We did it for nothing, you know, in a time where it still cost money to go into studios and et cetera. So we were using the studio of my Nashville songwriting friend. His dad had a company and they had a corporate studio, and we were using that studio after hours. Lots of cool things that worked together to make that happen, which was really only just a God thing.
Byron and Jennifer reunited just a few years ago, back where they first met, in the small college town in the southeast corner of Kansas.
We saw her in February of 20. It was right before the pandemic hit. She did a concert in Pittsburgh, and I went down there hung out, stayed after the show and had a nice conversation with her, took a picture and you know, everything. It was cool. It was definitely cool. It was interesting to see her in her own hometown. Everybody wanted to hear the songs off Kansas, and she didn't want to play the songs off Kansas.
For the record, no artist wants to strictly live in the past. They're artists, after all. They create and promote and create again. In the same token, fans almost always want to live in the past. They want to be transported through music to the different points in their lives when those songs were meaningful. And that's always the compromise between fans and artists. So in time, Jennifer started her own management company, looking for new up-and-coming artists to sign.
Katy Perry was signed to Jen's management label.
Before Katy Perry roared her way into the secular market, she caught Jennifer's eye when she was just 16. If you didn't know, Perry isn't her real last name. It's Hudson, and she actually had a burgeoning career in Christian music. As Byron mentioned, she signed with Jennifer's management label as Katie Hudson, released her self-titled debut in 2001, and opened for Newsboys alum Phil Joel.
The manager that managed Jen after me, he and her friend that traveled with them that we met at New Earth, the three of them started a management company, a Christian record artist man, and their first artist was Katie Hudson. So Jen was a part of Katie's and, you know, career as a Christian artist. Yeah, I wonder. I should ask Jen when I saw her if she ever talks to Katy Perry. So But yeah, Jen was a part of that.
It wasn't until after she left Nashville and moved to Los Angeles to embark on a secular career that Katie changed her last name to Perry, her mother's maiden name, since there was already an actress in town named Kate Hudson. But this podcast isn't about Katy Perry. It's about the one that first signed her, Jennifer Knapp, and the one that discovered Jennifer, Byron Funk.
You know, what I did with Jen was, that was the best thing ever for me. I like the, there was 20 kids at this show, and then the next week there was 25, and then the next week, 35. You know, that is super exciting to me because I like to mold that raw clay.
Speaking of discovering new talent, Byron has a new bit of raw clay that he is molding.
The name of the group is Marcotte. Jordan, this guy right here, he's a fantastic singer, songwriter. He's producing Marcotte, marcottemusic.com. Yeah. Marcotte. Sweet love of mine. You're the love of my sugar. You're the love of my life. Sweet, 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 sweet love of mine. You're the love of my sugar, you're the love of my life. Oh, you are sweeter with time, sweeter with time. They're both very strong Christians. He's a fantastic worship leader, but he feels a call to bring great music to not the Christian world completely, even though he's about to release a Christian record. But they do R&B stuff. They write R&B love songs, and they're fantastic. And I'm really excited for him and what he and they are doing.
By the way, both Marcotte and Jordan Marcotte music is available on all major online streaming services if your interest was piqued. So while Byron didn't remain a part of Jennifer's career once she signed with GoTee, he is still able to look back fondly on the whole experience.
I mean, the whole history part is pretty fascinating, and I love telling it because it's most of it is her, you know. I always told her she's one in a 4 billion girl. At the time, I think there were 4 billion people on the earth, and you know, she just had the magic of lots of things that went together. You know, it was God made her who she was, and she told the world about that, and she was just fantastic.
Jennifer not only left Byron's guidance, but after 3 albums, she left GoTee Records, Nashville, and contemporary Christian music altogether. As she explained, her faith started to shift away from core Christian beliefs, and she moved about as far away as she could, Australia.
I think kind of just maybe if I'd say anything kind of in line with some of the conversations we've had about, you know, what it means to be doing Christian music or what qualifies it or what doesn't, or what kind of goes into it that makes it, ultimately, I think any conversations about contemporary Christian music unique, is that, you know, the challenges that I had in coming back and playing music were, you know, I really wondered first off, I left the music because I couldn't see a way into continuing on a conversation when I had so much theologically in disagreement. And I think the expectations that I would be able to talk about Christianity in ways that were familiar and expected were already being challenged throughout the course of my career. And I think after 3 records, and by that time when I left, I was in my late 20s, and it was just getting really hard for me to not really want to talk very openly about my resistance to this evangelical expectation that, you know, you had to know Jesus in order to find anything useful by this endeavor, or that my responsibility as a musician was to only make more Christians. Like, I just didn't have a dog in that fight. And I had some real theological problems with that as well, that I think in order to be able to talk about with the latitude that I was going to need to do that, I recognized would be a disqualifying factor for me to be distributed, at least in those circles, which is okay because I wasn't really interested in and had never really been comfortable like propagating Christianity, like care where you found that joy. I just wanted you to have that joy and that hope. And if you ended up finding value in the faith tradition that I had learned that from, then I would be happy to be your mentor once you got there, I so to speak, or I guess it's one way to say it.
For those in the Christian faith, those words may sound harsh or sad. The business side of contemporary Christian music can often toe the line between secular and holy in its practices. But at its core, there is still the Great Commission. As believers in the gospel, there's only one way through Jesus Christ, one hope, and a peace that passes all understanding. While Jennifer has since chosen to distance herself from that faith and admittedly the evangelical subculture that exists, after a 9-year hiatus, she did pick up her guitar again.
In coming back and doing music, I think what I've appreciated, I was nervous about whether or not I actually had any talent at all as an artist or as a musician. And if I kind of had this sneaking suspicion that I might not have ever made any impact anywhere as an artist had it not been just kind of for the inbuilt success inside of CCM. Basically, you know, had I been marketed successfully, but in the real world, with music, you know, your music really does have to connect to people to exist and to live. And there's no guarantee, like for any of us who create or write anything, that it will resonate with, you know, anyone beyond ourselves. And so it's a real gift when you, you know, have the opportunity to have a career that way, because I would say to anybody who's writing a song, like, you know, I'm still here basically because I keep saying yes, because people keep asking me to play. And that's kind of all you ever get to do. Like, don't stop writing and doing what you're doing. And if people say yes, then go play. It's that simple. There's no guarantee that you'll be able to make a career of it. No obligation for anyone to give you a career just because you create and it means something. And so for even like, I think Kansas has stood the test of time largely because it wasn't a record created to transmit something. I feel very honored and accidentally privileged to be able to know that I basically wrote that record while nobody was looking. And I think years later, with all the rage and the negative and experiences of that, for people to come back and bring this record to me, it took me a long time to love this record again and to really appreciate the experience I had gone through because I'd been hurt, and to have to realize that that was a gift backward to me was really wonderful, because that had been a gift to them. And I think it's been a joy to be able to say somehow or other, I really helped put my hope into that idea and my care and my leadership and my faith into that thing, that I didn't just want to like repeat and tell you what you should do, but to paint a picture of the world and see where we go and travel together. So that's about all I'd say. Kansas has taught me a lot, and I didn't realize it at the time, but it's been a nice gift that a lot of people have given back to me to help me see how critical of and lucky I was for that to be the record that it was.
Thank you for joining us as we travel with Jennifer Knapp from Pittsburgh, Kansas, to the fields of Franklin, Tennessee, all the way to Australia and back to Kansas. A special thank you to Jennifer Knapp, Kim Bontrager, Byron Funk, and Taz Russell for their time, transparency, and authenticity. A few months after this interview took place, Jennifer announced that she was starting a Kickstarter campaign to re-record Kansas in its entirety for the 25th anniversary. And this time, there would be a vinyl record option available for those, like myself, who collect vinyls. The next season of the CCM Deep Dive podcast will be out later this spring, featuring the 1996 gold-selling album God with Rebecca St. James. Multiple Grammys and Dove Awards, multiple gold-selling albums, and multiple world tours, Rebecca is a giant in contemporary Christian music. Also in 2024, we will showcase the 2015 album Paradise by recording artist Ronnie Freeman. Listen to his incredible story of overcoming addiction, recording with Rocketown Records, and a message that he received in a painting while in Germany. All starting this spring on the CCM Deep Dive, wherever you enjoy podcasts.
I think in particular, as far as podcasts go, I think that will be very intriguing for a lot of people. Like, this will be one that I think people will feel like is an event.
gonna get the best of me. Minutes threaten through the years to carve wrinkles with my tears across the face with straining eyes to see. They're looking for the peace that passes all understanding in a world crazed with fear. They say that I am much too demanding to want a better place than here. So I go on the visions of prophets gave to me.
Chisels I've dulled, carving idols of stone that have crumbled like sand beneath the waves. I've recklessly built all my dreams in the sand just to watch them all wash away. Through another day, another trial, another chance to reconcile to one who sees past all I see. And reaching out my weary hand, I pray that you'd understand you're the only one who's faithful to me. All the pennies I've wasted in my wishing well, I have thrown like stones to the sea. I have cast my lots, dropped my guard, searched aimlessly for faith to be faithful to me. through another day, another trial, another chance to reconcile to one who sees past all I see. And reaching out my weary hand, I pray that you'd understand you're the only one who's faithful to me. You're the only one who's faithful to me.